Thank you very much to the organizers for amazing hospitality. So I'm so impressed and so happy that all of you could make it. I just wanted to tell a little bit about my background. I am originally from Ukraine. I came to study in the US for my graduate degree at Dartmouth College, and I worked for about 25 years in the pharmaceutical research and development industry in different roles. Ultimately, I started and ran several companies which are contractors, clinical trials contractors, because pharmaceutical companies don't do anything themselves. They hire contract research organizations, which is what we were doing, running their clinical trials. And as part of that, you're supposed to know everything about regulations that exist for drug development, for safety, especially for consumer protection reasons. And we were very careful following all those regulations. They're very extensive. And so that's my background. I know how to be in compliance with all the rules that exist for safety monitoring, both in clinical trials and then on the market, and in specifically in manufacturing. So when I started looking into this, I didn't understand everything. I just knew that something terrible was happening, both with suppression of hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin, which I knew were safe drugs. And when the FDA started going and saying these things, that these are dangerous, I knew that they were lying, and I knew that they knew that they were lying, because they're professionals, they're not stupid. That was a big question, what was happening. And 3 years into it, I know this is a crime. I look at it as a crime scene. The crime scene looks approximately like this. You have a nice person from health injecting people with we don't know what. And it causes severe adverse events. It causes deaths, estimated 17 million deaths worldwide. This needs to be treated as a crime scene at the moment, because at the beginning you could say it was some incompetence, maybe rushing, maybe they didn't know some things. But now, 3 years later, they're denying. They're denying anything is happening. They're laughing in the faces of the victims, pretending this doesn't exist. But it does exist, and there are 17 million people dead, including young people and children. So I started looking into this, and I realized that healthcare was weaponized. And I'm not going to talk about all of this, because some of this will be covered by my other colleagues, and Dr. Corey talked about it. We know that these products are toxic by design. There is no safety, no efficacy. But most importantly, I looked into bad manufacturing. Very few people understand pharmaceutical manufacturing. None of my colleagues was speaking, and I decided that I need to speak about this. Also, we know about malignant policy, government policy worldwide, suppression and censorship. And all of this points to intentional acts, intent to harm. I looked into batch variability, and fortunately today my colleague Max and Vibeke, they will be talking about that separate lecture just on that topic, so I'm not going to cover that. But after batch variability, I found a lot of colleagues who were directly testing vials, picking up vials either after the patients or new ones, and looking and trying to understand what's in them, because we were not, at that point, we didn't believe already what the pharma was saying or regulators were saying, and there were huge issues with quality and reliability. And what was found is that what is advertised on the label doesn't conform to what is found in the vial. In fact, to date, I am aware of thousands of these tests, not a single vial was found in conformance with the label. There's always something wrong. Okay, sorry. So for example, the RNA that advertised there is not conforming to the sequence it's supposed to be by length, and there are lots and lots of broken, what we call broken pieces. That's a problem, a huge safety risk. There is plasmid DNA contamination I will address on the next page. There are toxic metals found almost all the time, different ones. And I have a long list here. You can see many of them are really dangerous. The substance itself is a hydrogel. That was never explained. But you can see this sparkling kind of appearance on the microscope. That's hydrogel. There are also objects found, micro and macro objects in an injectable product, which is never supposed to happen. We don't know what they are. They look like this. This is very typical appearance, and we have no idea what that is. It needs to be explained. And there are different like ribbons and things. And this is found both in the vials and then in the blood of injected people. I was talking about the contamination of plasmid DNA. This looks very technical, but I will make you an expert very quickly. A researcher in outside of Boston, Kevin McKernan, has a DNA lab, and he got hold of some vials in different batches from both Pfizer and Moderna, and he sequenced the vials, the DNA. And he found he found what's called plasmid DNA. Plasmid DNA is a circular synthetic piece of DNA. That's why these two are circles. And it's introduced in bioengineering into a vat of E. coli cells. Those cells replicate quickly. They absorb these plasmids and they replicate quickly. And that's how you grow DNA in the lab. And then they're supposed to be harvested and it becomes a raw material for making RNA. Then you make RNA from it, then you have to purify and remove all the remaining pieces of DNA, plasmid DNA, or anything else that was there. Now, obviously, that doesn't happen in this process because Kevin found these things floating in the vials, in the end product. So number one expertise, none of this should be in the vial at all. Okay, and then number two expertise is on the left-hand side, the circle is what Kevin found in the vial. On the yellow circle is what Pfizer submitted to the regulators as a disclosure. And turns out they forgot to mention that they have what's called SV40 promoter for some reason. And that's a particularly dangerous component. Because, it was famously, it's part of the SV40 virus, as infamously associated with a polio vaccine, which is known it causes cancer. But this promoter is in there. And in scientific research, it's known to be an agent to deliver whatever it's attached to into the nucleus of the cell where our DNA resides. So this can interfere with our DNA processes, be incorporated into genome, cause cancer, cause cell death, all sorts of issues, wherever it goes. So the plasmid DNA was not supposed to be in the vial at all. It was supposed to be purified, but obviously in manufacturing process, this doesn't happen. And then they put a component in it, which they did not disclose to anyone, including regulators. That last part is very important because that makes it a biological weapon. I'm showing you a report from U.S. Air Force. The report mentions that since 1997 in the United States, this Jason Group, which is a science advisory group to U.S. President, designed these six categories of what technologies, biomanufacturing technologies, can potentially be weaponized. And then the report discusses how that can happen. And the gene therapy was designated as a weaponizable technology. So while in theory there are some health applications for it, it can also be dual use. So many technologies can be dual use, and that's not unusual. You can use something for good or for bad, for offense or defense. So that in itself is not a problem. But the way they described that gene therapy could be weaponized, and the way to weaponize it is to add stealth components to the genetic code, to add something like what we saw, SV40. That's your stealth component. And actually, plasmid DNA also has a stealth component, as it's not supposed to be there. So that meets the definition of U.S. Air Force for a biological weapon or biochemical weapon, because a lot of it is not just biological, but synthetic chemistry as well. And in addition to that, of course, we know these products killed a lot of people, as I said, estimated 17 million worldwide. But specifically, the lot that Kevin McKernan sequenced, I looked it up in the CDC Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, and I found that it did kill people. Specifically, it killed children. This is a report for a 10-year-old child who was injected from this lot, FL8095, and he died, healthy child. He died one day after he was injected. Furthermore, and you can see he died from cardiac arrest, torsade de pointe QT prolongation arrhythmia, which is lethal. And I also found that the same lot was associated with over 1,400 total adverse events, mostly in children, and 65 serious and life-threatening events, and 62 of them in children. This lot has never been removed from the market or investigated by the regulators, despite of what, you know, we've been trying to tell them, sending letters. I talked to senators, I talked to Senator Johnson from Wisconsin in the US, and he wrote a letter based on my analysis of batch variability. And all of this was dismissed, even in internal email communications that later were FOIA'd. He was called misinformation and conspiracy theorist by Peter Marks, head of CBER at FDA. There are these emails telling, you know, Ron Johnson is running around asking these questions. He's a conspiracist. This has never been addressed properly. In addition, so this is in the U.S. In Europe, there is a regulator, European Medicines Agency. It's a EU regulator similar to FDA. Use similar rules. In fact, they're all harmonized internationally. And at the end of 2020, there was a leak of information from EMA, and a lot of FOIA documents and emails came out. And we realized that what was going on was called bait and switch. So they're saying something that, you know, they're telling you it's a pharmaceutical, but in fact, they're not regulating it as a pharmaceutical. So there was an opinion in that leaked document package. There was an opinion of the European regulators written up, stating specifically that Pfizer was not compliant with good manufacturing practices, which is a huge violation. If something is not compliant with good manufacturing practices, it cannot be approved. There were switches made in manufacturing process. Regulators were deemed the data non-comparable, non-reliable. There was no validation. There was a lot of proprietary black box, unexplained processes, a lot of missing data. Overall, there were 117 major objections and concerns written by European Medicines Agency review teams. And in my personal experience, even if you had like three or four major objections, you could not go forward. You could not approve the drug. You had to resolve all that before you could approve. And here they had 117 and nothing was done. 2 weeks later, so they just wrote up a lot of objections. It's as if, you know, you drove at 100 miles an hour in a 50-mile zone. You got, you know, 100 times, you got 100 tickets, and the cops do nothing. Nobody is removing your license and they're allowing you to drive again. That's exactly what happened here. So they ignored all these written objections and approved the drug and deployed it globally. Also, in the same package of documents, we saw Ursula von der Leyen manipulating, actually emails between EMA staff saying that Ursula von der Leyen was going to talk to every head of European member state to push them all into central purchasing of Pfizer and Moderna products. Remember those famous contracts that she negotiated by text message? And we still don't have them fully officially disclosed. So I encourage anyone who wants to talk to your government officials, this is a small country, they must disclose the contract that they signed. And you will see, so there are some contracts that have leaked, so we know what they say, but somebody needs to produce them officially. So the contracts, in fact, identified Pfizer for any liability and also further forced the governments to put state assets as collateral in case Pfizer gets sued, and in case the citizens of the country win against Pfizer, then the government must pay. And when the government must pay, it means the people must pay, right? So it's people's money. So they're saying, if your people are injured, those people must pay. It's like forcing the victims of the crime to pay for liability, right? So that's what they did. Obviously, the regulatory approval was a sham, and regulators didn't know or didn't care about what was in these vials. Everybody said that they were just following orders, but it's very curious whose orders they were following. I started looking into this, and I found Catherine's research online about the law, the laws that were changed in the United States. And we also found a lot of similar laws all over the world. In Europe, there are definitely laws similar to what was done in the US, and I'm going to explain a little bit here. So first of all, Operation Warp Speed was a military operation. It wasn't told to us, like they didn't tell us explicitly. All the press and media stories about it was that, it's just military is going to participate because of these wonderful logistics capabilities that they have. But in fact, they were in charge of this operation. As far as the changes of what they've done with the legal structure or perverted legal structure, pseudo-legal structure, Catherine is going to explain in more detail. But it's important to understand that overall what's being utilized is this public health emergency as a pretense to cover up for essentially a global military operation. The law about public health emergency was put on the books in the United States in the 80s. Prior to that, U.S. Constitution did not anticipate anything like a public health emergency that affects the entire nation. Of course, the U.S. is a huge country. It covers a continent. It has enormous diversity, both in people and geography and climate and distances. And so, it's not possible to have a public health emergency that affects everyone equally. Yet that's what the law says. And in fact, when it's invoked, it neuters the Constitution. It reads this because they need to continue the party line, the narrative, the propaganda, to protect themselves from any liability. Now, countermeasures, pretend medicines, they're not medicines. They're medicines, in quotations, without regulatory or any consumer safeguards. And so here in the U.S. law, this is the law that I learned from Catherine. She found this. Use of emergency use authorized covered medical countermeasures is not a clinical investigation in U.S. law, meaning that it's not possible in principle to do a clinical trial for a countermeasure. There is no the clinical trial rules and laws that we have on the books do not apply to this. So they lied about that key part. They ran a clinical trial, but by law, it's not possible. So whatever clinical trial they ran was a demonstration. In fact, that's how they were purchased. Also, these countermeasures are deployed by Health and Human Services Secretary unilaterally based on his or her opinion that it may be effective. There is no evidence required from a clinical trial, and they can consult whoever they want to consult. But they're not obligated to have any standard, or any evidentiary standard for safety and efficacy, only an opinion that it may be effective. Returning to the Operation Warp Speed and military operation, this slide is from Operation Warp Speed own documents, own PowerPoints. They made it, and it was FOIA'd later. So this is from October 2020. And here they're discussing their own organizational structure. So this is their org chart, but it's turned on the side. And so you can see that at the head of this operation, Chief Operating Officer is the Department of Defense. But we were told it was just logistics. Well, it turns out they're running the entire operation. Health and Human Services, and as you know, contains FDA and CDC and other health agencies in the U.S., is only a chief science advisor. In fact, chief operating officer of this during Trump administration and later under Biden was General Gustav Berna. He's now retired and replaced with another military person, and the whole operation is renamed into Project NextGen, and also funded, and they're making new vaccines, and they're continuing the same thing in the same organizational structure. So nothing changed, really. You can also see that the whole top executive layer of this organization is U.S. government, Department of Defense, and BARDA, which is Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority. They're responsible for everything, all the executive layer functions, including supply, production, distribution, manufacturing, security, legal, and clinical trials, design, everything. And they all hired contractors to do the job. The pharma companies are the third layer down. They're suppliers. They just follow the orders. But they're very happy because they make a lot of money. And that's how, by the way, so the top layer is appropriating and using public money. Pfizer, for example, was given $10 billion for this contract from the Department of Defense. So they use our money, taxpayers' money, then give it to private companies and extract private profits, huge profits. Then in the same slide deck from Operation Warp Speed, they were talking about their vaccine manufacturing portfolio. And as you can see, there are a lot of suppliers that people are not aware of, hundreds of companies. For example, Pfizer supply chain is something like 130 companies performing this job. And so at the time, they were showing some of them here. They call it vaccine supporting efforts, but those are actually the manufacturers. And then on the left-hand side, what they call vaccines, those were just companies with big brand names that they brought in to put their labels on this production that was already set up, and convince the public that this is something wonderful, safe, and effective. But they're themselves very careful when they write these slides because they know that this is going to be FOIA'd and there are going to be lawsuits and complaints. So they very carefully wrote on those blue boxes. Might not see this, but in every blue box, it says the word demo. And under vaccine supporting efforts, that's manufacturing. So demo is, and I'm going to skip this slide just for time's sake. So the contracts became available and FOIA'd, hundreds of them. This is just a small fraction of them I'm showing here. They're all publicly available in partially redacted form. All of them, as you can see, are circled. They all say DOD. DOD is an originator and contracting entity and the entity that distributes the money. And there are hundreds of companies covering not just the vaccines, but all the supply chain and diagnostics and therapeutics and propaganda and lies. Also, many, many grants were given to media through the same methods. All of this was distributed by Robert Kudlick personally. And then I also have a link here where you can see all these contracts available. And importantly, key contracts were produced in litigation. So I don't know if you know about Brooke Jackson's lawsuit. She was one of the clinical trial managers for Pfizer, and she noticed a lot of fraud. Complained about it, was fired, and then started suing them under False Claims Act. And so during Pfizer's own, they had to produce the contract in their own defense. They argued with the court that, in their defense, they wanted to dismiss the lawsuit. In the motion to dismiss, they produced this, and they said, you know, we were not, you know, we're not defrauding the government. We were hired to do a manufacturing demonstration. So this is what I've highlighted here, large-scale vaccine manufacturing demonstration. In fact, most of the contracts are written this way, and demonstration by definition is fake. It's not the real thing. So they're saying, we didn't defraud the government, we delivered what they ordered, fraud. You know, and so the case was dismissed by judge, by federal judge, and it's now being appealed. There isn't a lot of hope for it, but the main achievement was this. They were cornered, they had to argue in their defense and to produce these contracts. And that's why I'm saying the contracts must be produced. Your government must disclose what are those terms? What did they promise to Pfizer? How did they buy these products? Why are they doing this? And so in summary, I'd like to say that vaccine development and approval was a performance art to fool the public and especially fool the professional class, the doctors, the pharmacists, the nurses, the academics, so that they can all fall for this narrative. What the contracts ordered from the US Department of Defense was demonstration, fake. Clinical trials were not ordered by those contracts, and in principle, in law, they're not possible for countermeasures. Good manufacturing compliance was also not ordered. It's mentioned in the contracts, but it's unenforceable. And if it's unenforceable, it's as if it doesn't exist. So, and in fact, again, it's not possible for, doesn't apply for countermeasures. And legally, there was no clinical trial subjects or investigators, and definitely no informed consent. Even when they're claiming the products are fully approved, still they're shipping the boxes with blank product inserts. And finally, what I would like to say that I hope you understand why I'm calling it a crime, because a medical product for which there is no liability, all risk is forced onto the recipients, and all profits are privatized, is not a medical product at all. It's poison. And it should be treated as such. And it should be treated as a mass murder by poisoning. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Susan. What speaker do you want to have next time? Next. Catherine.
What?
Varsågod på svenska. Welcome.
Thank you. And thank you to the organizers for inviting me and Sasha for inviting me more strongly than. Anyway, I don't do a lot of public speaking. I'm a writer and a paralegal, and I'm trying to open.
How do I get it to slide?
Okay, and then I just got it. So I'm a writer and I'm a paralegal, and I got involved in these things starting from a background. I was raised as a traditional Roman Catholic, and that's relevant to the work that I've done since, because prior to Vatican II in the 1960s, the Catholic Church had very clear teachings about the difference between truth and error, the nature of man, his final ends, and relations between man and society. And because I was raised in that traditional Catholic upbringing, that was kind of the stuff that was going on in my house. I drifted away from my Catholic faith as a teenager, and then I came back to it during COVID, because as it dawned on me how evil the big picture was, it also dawned on me that for that coordinated of an evil to be getting So far, there must be something even more good against which it was fighting. And that brought me back into the faith. But in my young adult, I went to Penn State. I studied philosophy and natural sciences. I worked as a reporter after that for small newspapers. And then I got a paralegal certificate. And a paralegal, I understand you don't have those in Iceland, but in the United States, a paralegal is a legal assistant who works for lawyers, but the things they can't do are sign documents and appear in court on behalf of people. But pretty much they can do everything else. We learn how to do legal research. We learn how to do legal writing. We learn how to look at the facts of the case when the client brings them in and apply the law that we have researched to the facts of that case. So when COVID began in the beginning of 2020, that was the skill set with which I had to try to understand what was happening. And I'm here because Sasha located my work. I was writing on my website, which is Bailiwick News on Substack. And also during my adult life, I started several blogs and I did investigative reporting on other issues that turned out to be related, primarily one called preemption doctrine, which is an American legal principle where higher levels of government can supersede each lower level. And I learned about it in the context of concentrated agricultural feed operations. They're called CAFOs in the United States. It's when a company, any corporation, wants to come into a community and do something that the local community thinks will be bad for them or bad for their water or bad for their air. The local communities would try to pass laws at the local level to stop it, and they would quickly find out that the state could preempt that and tell them, no, you have to accept this thing that you do not want and it's dangerous for your population. So that was what I had been doing for 15 years at the end of 2019. So I was looking at, I live in Pennsylvania in the United States, and I was watching the lockdowns and the mask mandates, and I had familiarity with constitutional law and civil rights law and a little bit with criminal law, and I couldn't figure out why the cases that were being brought by businesses, especially, who were saying why they were suing the state government, particularly the governor, to say, we have a right to our property, we have a right to our business to be open, you can't come in with these executive orders and just shut things down. And the governor said, yes, I can. And the one case that was most powerful was one called Butler versus Yates, because it was business owners plus a county government suing the governor, or Butler versus Wolf is our governor at the time. And the federal judge got the case in May of 2020, and in September of 2020, issued a really good ruling that said, these business owners are correct. There may be an emergency, but the Constitution is designed to be strong enough to withstand emergencies and still protect individual liberties. And 3 weeks later, the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the next level up, put a hold on that federal decision and allowed the executive orders that were shutting down businesses and closing schools and all that to stand. And it was that pattern that I saw over and over again, where a case would come up and then something would come out, I couldn't tell where it was coming from the side, and knock it out before it could do the constitutional function that the courts are meant to do. I have since found out, like just in the last few weeks, a reader referred me to the work of Nikki Rapana and Nordica Friedrich on something called communitarian law. And that is one of the names for this like blanket of other globally driven law that comes into countries and smothers their constitutional law, their criminal codes, everything else under these kinds of circumstances, like what Sasha was talking about with the public health emergency, which is how I tracked it through in 2021 and 2022. And all of these findings can be replicated. You can go to the legal system, and the main post that I did about it is called the American Domestic Bioterrorism Program. That's the one, it's a timeline of the laws that are specific to the United States. But the exact same thing is in place in these countries all around the world because it's driven from higher than the nation state level. So, as I say, I was watching these cases, I was really confused. 2021, got to the beginning of 2022, and I heard a podcast by an attorney, American attorney Todd Callender, in January of 2022, and he talked about the World Health Organization's International Health Regulations 2005 amendments as being the thing that tied these things together that comes in from outside of a nation state and supersedes or sort of manipulates its law. And so I did a first report at the end of February in 2022 called Legal Walls of the COVID-19 Kill Box. And that report was more on the global level, the bigger picture. And then I kept digging into the specific American laws that implement the IHR 2005 amendments. And I know you all know that they're going through another round of revisions right now. And James Roguski is reporting on it, and Meryl Nass is reporting on it, and lots of people are reporting on it. The 2005 ones are the ones that I did the most research on because that's what was in place already at the time that COVID hit. What I found was that things seem to have gotten really underway in 1944 with the congressional passage of the Public Health Service Act, which established a new branch of the military that was the Public Health Service. And from that foundation, all of these other things got added on to each other, sort of like Legos. You put the bricks on brick by brick by brick, and then you end up with this wall that sort of surrounds us now. Another key turning point was the 1983 Public Health Emergencies Program, which was added again by an act of Congress. And Sasha mentioned that too. And then the two, there's hundreds of pages of these laws. They are in lots and lots of different titles, which is sections of U.S. law. Like they're in the Homeland Security section, they're in the Food, Drug, and Cosmetics Act section, and they interweave with each other. And Sasha was talking about that too. The especially bad ones that really put the last pieces into place were the Project BioShield Act in 2004 and the PrEP Act in 2005. And the way that the international health regulations work is that it's not a treaty, it's called a legally binding instrument of international law. So it's like a treaty. And once it is passed through these insane procedures that the World Health Assembly does with negotiators that are, this is more than Jim Roguski covers. By default, if the World Health Assembly representatives pass something at their annual meeting in May, according to the law of the World Health Organization and the IHR, those things automatically go into effect 18 months later, unless the political body of the member state explicitly rejects those amendments and says we are not going to accept them. And that's what's going on right now. There were a set of amendments adopted by the World Health Assembly in May 2022, which will automatically go into effect in December 2023 unless the legislatures and executives of the member states reject them. And none of them appear to be interested in doing that at this time, but they should. And so, lost my train of thought a little bit. The overall point is that it forces member states to adopt implementing legislation because they are a member state, because they've signed this treaty. And that's what happened. Like, all of the laws that are in place in the United States were done to comply with this. And it's ongoing. Like, every few months they add more. So my core findings were that public health emergencies are a pretext for power consolidation and legalized mass murder, using state-sponsored biochemical warfare and weapons camouflaged as vaccines and countermeasures. This is what Sasha was talking about too. But I also think that a secondary goal, almost as important, if not more important, is that they want to orchestrate constitutional crises worldwide, because that will help them consolidate more power with the globalist organizations. If they can get people really angry with their own governments, creative cabinet flage as a public health program, and they can delegate the license to kill down to the lower levels, which is the county health departments and the pharmacies and whoever else they need to, with no criminal or civil liability. And the core provision here is 42 USC. Well, I won't say it, but it says no matter what any other law says, a person who acts on this Health and Human Services Authority and follows these orders cannot be prosecuted criminally or civilly. They have immunity, which is essentially the just following orders defense from the Nuremberg Code, but it's made into being completely legal. So the conclusion I reached after I had looked at these laws and I looked at what was happening with what Jessica Rose and all the people, Sasha, everybody that was looking at the VAERS data, that these are intentional acts of war camouflaged as public health programs and medical countermeasures. And this was supported by the evidence from people like John O'Looney, Mike Eden, Brooke Jackson's case, and even also on the financial side with Catherine Austin Fitz and John Titus.
Yeah, am I supposed to be done? No. Oh, okay.
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 So what it looks like to me and what I write about at my website is that it's a covert global civil war, and most people don't even know that they're in this war yet. But the three priorities for the people who do know, who have initiated it, are they want to be perceived as legitimate. They want people to think that the concentration of power makes sense because there's this big emergency and they need to rely on the central government because the central government knows what to do. And they also, at the same time, need people to think that their own governments are incompetent. And that's what I was kind of talking about before, because this whole thing, in my view, is setting up the conditions for people to abandon their own countries, their loyalties to their own countries, their sense of their own people, and the legitimacy of their own political unit to turn it over to the United Nations and the World Economic Forum and Gates and whoever else. They also need speed because they're trying to reduce world population, especially in North America and Western Europe, apparently to meet a deadline in 2030. And at the same time, they need plausible deniability. They need people not to know what's happening and not to figure it out, not to stop taking the boosters, not to stop fighting. Like, yes, they want them to stop fighting against what they're doing. And sometimes those priorities are in conflict. So they were trying to go gradually with the legal changes and gradually with vaccines. And I don't think Sasha talked about this, but I did vaccinate my kids. I was vaccinated myself. I now regret those enormously because now I can see that they were doing it for longer with lower dose toxins that were less obvious than what these ones did. But that wasn't going fast enough. So they pulled the whole COVID program and made it happen. And because they did it so fast and so hard and so coordinated, it woke a lot of people up. And that's where we're at now, because they were trying to like balance these plausible deniability and speed and went too fast and too hard. So I get a lot of different responses to this. The first one is usually this makes sense of things that are not well explained just by regulatory capture, just by big pharma profiteering, just by like the regulators not being competent. And then the second response I get is, what the hell? How can this be happening? How can governments be doing this on purpose? How can the regulators be playing along? how can the counties be playing along and the states, and it not be stopped? And so I have had to come up with some provisional answers. I think it has to do with financial and debt reduction. They want fewer people getting health care. They want fewer people getting pensions. They want longevity to go down. And this is the same analysis that Catherine Austin Fitz talks about a lot. Some people talk about the AI robotics. There's a surplus population because they don't need the workers anymore that may have been useful in the past. And the other one is just the pure evil part of this desire to control and enslave people just because they want to do that. Then people ask me to speculate about who, and I think it's the private owners of the Bank for International Settlements and the National Central Banks, because they are the ones who have the leverage over the national governments to say, do this, or we will cut you off from all of your international financial transactions. And they demonstrate that. They demonstrated it with Cyprus and Greece and the Vatican in 2012, 2013. So the other ones know, like, you know, they really can do it. And the other thing I've found is that emotionally processing it is much, much more difficult than just understanding the facts and the mechanics of it. So the biggest, most often question is, what do we do? And the first thing, I say this, Sasha says this, is enjoy your life as much as you can, as fully as you can, in the way that human beings do, like loving and spending time with your family and friends, doing good work, praying, because one of the things that's really important to them is to just make people disconnect from being human and disconnect from each other and the higher God. And so the second thing is to defy all the orders to hurt yourself. Don't do it. Don't take any more if you've taken some of the shots. Don't get your kids vaccinated or bioweaponed. And help others do it, because other people may want to do it, but they may not feel like they can because they're isolated and they don't know all the things. So if you can help people you know say, yes, it's right, you should defy these orders, you should not take these things. The third thing is to understand it. It takes time, and speak up about it. Specifically on the legal side, Brooke Jackson's case was excellent because she really believed at the beginning that fraud was a crime that should be punished and that the laws criminalized. And what she found, or what her case revealed, is that that is not the case. Some people are allowed to do fraud and not get prosecuted. So filing more cases that are better designed to draw out those similar kinds of responses would be very good. And then the other ones are pushing lawmakers and courts to kind of throw off this smothering blanket of the communitarian law and reassert constitutional rule of law by what they have to do is certainly repeal things like the Project BioShield Act and the PREP Act, because if they don't repeal that, the power stays in the Health and Human Services Secretary's hands, because like I said before, courts can't nullify it, Congress can't override it, states can't override it, but Congress can repeal the law that Congress itself passed. They do need to build a majority to do that, but regular people can push for that. 5 minutes, okay. And then the other one is to push lawmakers all around the world to withdraw from these supranational treaties and conventions. This is the exit WHO, exit the EU, exit the Bank for International Settlements, exit the UN, all of them. I think this is a repeat, yes. The one other thing I wanted to mention is that I recently, in my research, because I've been looking more at EU stuff, and I have lists at my website of the EU regulations and directives and decisions that are similar to the ones in the United States, in the sense that once the EU Commission drafts it and the European Parliament rubber stamps it, it's automatically binding on the member states in the EU. And they have similar ones about genetically modified GMO pharmaceuticals and things like that. They have things about emergency, public health emergencies and things that trigger automatic financial contributions by the member states into the EU once the EU says there is this public health emergency situation, which they did with COVID. And that research has taken me into the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties, which was adopted in 1969 and then entered into force in 1980. And it has a provision for how you get out of treaties, which has to do with fundamental change of circumstance. So I think it's arguable that the public discovery that individuals who are pretending to represent legitimate governments are actually engaged in a mass murder campaign would count as a fundamental change of circumstance that would give the governments the moral right and the legal right to withdraw their countries from those treaties, including the International Health Regulations of 2005, the entire World Health Organization Constitution, which started in 1946. And so that's an area where I'm going to be doing more research and more writing. And then I'll close with a little bit more about the relevance of the Catholic teaching, because Pope Pius XII in 1952, but he gave a speech on the moral limits of medical research and treatment just after the Nuremberg trials. And in that speech, he made the point that insofar as the moral justification of experiments rests on the mandate of the public authority, and therefore on the subordination of the individual to the community and of the individual's welfare to the common welfare, it's based on an erroneous explanation of this principle. It must be noted that in his personal being, in his own body, in his own life, man is not finally ordered to usefulness of society. On the contrary, the community exists for man. And that's the sort of distinction that we're dealing with now, because the totalitarians at the World Economic Forum and the Bank for International Settlement pervert the concept of the common good to say that individuals are subordinate to the common good and that you can do anything you want to an individual, up to and including killing them, if you can make a case or if you can get enough people to believe that that's good for the planet or it's good for the control of this coronavirus or whatever. So restoring the proper understanding of the purpose of society and how man fits with it is really important too. Thank you.